Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders.
Plato's power base came from his global economic interests. He made his initial fortune in hydrogen technology and compounded this work with wise investments in the bio-cleansing industry. With his wealth and contacts, Plato was better placed than most to foresee the likely outcome of an escalating conflict between the superpowers. Always a prudent man, he began to move his money to a group of islands at the bottom of the world, known then as Aotearoa. By the time the first plague was released at the end of 2052, the Republic was already sealed off from the world. Plato was revered as the saviour of Aotearoa, and as the reports from the outside world became grimmer, he became known also as the saviour of the human race itself. Plato identified what he called the five great threats to order: impurity of breeding, impurity of thoughts, indulgence of the individual, commerce, and the outsider.
Not quite the 4th century Greek Republic familiar to readers of Plato's Republic, but not a million miles from it either. That was from Genesis, a new novel for young adults by the New Zealand author Bernard Beckett. This week we're going to be looking at the implications of putting Plato's philosophy into practice, and then we'll have a look at a philosophy that claims to have life-shaping influences, the Indian school of Vedanta. Let's begin, appropriately enough, with Genesis. It's the story of a young woman called Anaximander. In ancient Greece, Anaximander was a man, but then so was everybody else, if you believe Plato. And she's sitting an exam in front of the academy, who run the place after the fall of the Republic. Her subject is the life of Adam Ford, who seems to have played an important role in that fall. And where is the Republic? Well, I put it to Bernard Beckett that, geographically at least, it bears a strong resemblance to New Zealand.
Purely in the sense that it's an excuse to have an isolated place, and then they don't get a whole heap more isolated than my little home island. Yes. So that, yeah, not in the sense that there's any sort of New Zealand hangover.
So, as I say, it's called the Republic. Anaximander is up for examination for membership of the Academy, which runs the state. So it looks as though what we're talking about here is Plato's Republic, plus a bit of genetic engineering and robotics. Is that right?
Yeah, I think very much Plato's Republic, in that the sense of the philosopher king and the very tied down Spartan notion of bringing children up in a mechanical, a factory sort of a way, or as a manufacturing process in some sense. And that becomes a backdrop. In the end, it doesn't become a huge backdrop to the novel, in that the story goes in a different direction, as you know. And the story ends up actually with a prisoner and an artificial intelligence form, which is, to me, the core of the novel.
Obviously, you're not the first person to see the Republic, the utopian state depicted by Plato in his book The Republic, as a pretty totalitarian kind of place, and possibly modelled indeed on Sparta, which was a fairly controlled society. Yeah. As in Plato's Republic, in the days of the Republic, in the time of Adam, and we will come to him properly in a minute, in the Republic, the citizens were quite rigidly divided, as Plato divides his citizens into various classes. Yeah. Tell us about them, how you get to be a member of a class and how you can change class.
With this one, as you mentioned rightly earlier, there's a little bit of a genetic twist. So rather than the sort of Spartan idea of seeing if this baby was going to turn up healthy, there's actually, at a particular age, a genetic reading, as well as an environmental reading of that person, and from there they were being assigned to classes. There was an ability also for a person, as they grew, if people could move up and down. There's also a hint that later, as things started to fall apart, as one would expect, the top classes, as we see again and again in history, starts to defend itself, starts to tie off entry, starts to maintain the right to stay in touch with its children and so forth. So there was a hint in the story we get of the history that that then began to fall apart as the powerful elite sought to, you know, protect those things that are most precious.
Just talking about what the various classes are, sure. I was personally pleased to see that the top class are the philosophers.
Of course.
Yes. Yeah. And who are the others?
And then you got yourself a soldiering class, and then below them a group of workers. And then later, as the society progressed technologically, the promise was that that lowest class could be in fact replaced by machines. And the thought they were trying to protect themselves against was the uprising of, if you like, the proletariat. That if you could have no people in the people class, if they could all be machines, was there a way of, you know, guarding against that?
Let's get to Adam then.
Sure.
Anaximander's examination topic is the life of Adam Ford, who died young back in 2077. We see him serving as a guard on the seacoast of the Republic, washing out for refugees who might bring plague from the disaster-torn outside world. The Republic is held together by fear of the outside.
Yeah very much. And that's a, you know, it's such a contemporary theme. The ability, I think, more and more of fear to drag us to our television sets, to our consumption decisions and so forth, means that it's a powerful force that is being used again and again to grab our attention. The downside of that fear, to me, is almost immeasurable. And, of course, you know, you fall for the trap of nostalgia, but you talk to your peers about what it was like growing up and how closely your parents watched you and when they knew where you were or weren't, and compare that not only to what you see in children today, but what your own instinct would be with children today. And I say that as a school teacher, and I know I've been changed, and even though I'm aware of it, even though I'm really switched into that idea that, look, this is just this paranoia that's become an obsession of ours, I fall prey to it because the message comes again and again of what could go wrong.
In this rationally ordered society, the rationally ordered society of the Republic, Adam is, or is presented as, something of a romantic. He says that the greater good can be found only by looking inside. So are we meant to see him as potentially, at least, a transitional figure to a new world?
Yeah, very much. The name Adam, of course, you know, gives us the notion that Anaximander's being examined on a creation myth.
Later on, we see Adam sharing a prison cell with an android called Art.
Yep.
Now, Art himself is a transitional figure, isn't he, between the computer as calculating machine and the android as person or as potential person.
Absolutely, and that, to me, is the theme of the novel. And I think I say that in the sense that that is the theme that dragged me to this novel. And so the very idea of, as modern neuroscience takes us to the very, very edge of, and I mean, you know, it's so easy to overstate, but the very edge of understanding that this thing we call thought and experience has, at the very least, a physical counterpart, can be represented physically, even though that doesn't actually explain consciousness in a satisfactory way. But understanding there's a physical side to it immediately asks the question, well, could that experience, that thing we call consciousness, be replicated physically? Is it tied to biological machinery? Is there any good reason why it couldn't be, you know, a silicon-based life form in this, is sort of the metaphor used here. And that, you know, that starts throwing up all sorts of things. So if you're talking to kids in schools, you know, you ask simple questions like, you can be prosecuted in this country for torturing a cat with fireworks, of course, but you can't be prosecuted for turning your computer off or throwing it in a miniskip. But, you know, my cat can't use a cat door and my computer can beat me at chess. So what's that about cats and computers? And, you know, as a starting point for a discussion.
Now, Adam is reluctant to accord Art the status of a person, and in this he invokes the Chinese room argument. Now, this is an argument very famous in the field of discussions about artificial intelligence, first posed by the American philosopher John Searle. Tell us about that.
The question has always been, is there more to conscious response than a simple mechanical model? So once we got to, and you can go back to, I guess, to Alan Turing, who conveniently is at the founding point both of the technology of computers but also the philosophy of artificial intelligence with the Turing test, from that moment where we suddenly had this thing, this machine that was doing calculations which seemed to us to be tremendously complex, it became a very tempting metaphor for the human mind. It's like, gosh, well, now we said, look, it's this digital system and it's got decision paths and all the rest of it. So maybe that's what the mind is. And there's always been a philosophical school that has resisted that very strongly, as much as there's been a philosophical school that's embraced it. And Searle's argument, as I understand it, was simply, well, there must be more to conscious response than the sum of its parts. And his metaphor was, imagine a room that is tremendously complex, full of levers and so forth, and you can imagine it any way you like, but in essence we're thinking a computer of some sorts. And outside the room is a person who speaks one language, and inside the room is a person who does not speak that language. And Searle says, well, what happens if the person passes a message through and the non-speaker takes the message and uses that as a template for punching into the machine, and the machine words and so forth, and tells the person what to write or say back? And Searle's argument is, a conversation can take place, but nobody in that room is conscious of that conversation. So there is the mechanics all occurring, but consciousness is not occurring. Therefore, his conclusion, doesn't that mean that the conscious experience of conversation is quite different to the mechanical process by which a conversation could conceivably occur?
And this cuts no ice with art. I mean, art just says, well, I am the Chinese room. You've got a problem with that.
Yeah, well, his argument is, the great assumption that you make in the Chinese room is that the levers themselves cannot be conscious. We assume that the only thing that could be conscious of the conversation is the person in the room who isn't. But why can't the room itself be conscious? And that poses the possibility that this thing we call communication, what you and I are now doing, which is actually in real-time processing, listening to each other, responding and making these noises, actually requires consciousness. That is actually not a byproduct or an emergent quality of the sort of complexity of this process. And if the room is complex enough to kid the outsider, then the room is also complex enough for consciousness to emerge.
There's also the notion in your book that we're entering on a new age and that the sovereignty of humanity is going to be usurped by the idea, capital I. Mm. Now, to me, the idea sounds like what Richard Dawkins calls a meme. That is to say, an idea that has, as it were, an independent existence and of which we are just the carriers. Is that right?
Yeah, I came across the idea from Dawkins first in the meme, although interestingly I then came across Karl Popper's Three Worlds sort of model, which predates that and is in a lot of ways a clearer expression to me. Dawkins took the evolutionary side, which I exploit in the novel, that an idea that is attractive, that finds itself good at replicating within minds, has power and will take off for no reason other than it somehow fits well with the architecture of both the mind and communication. I think Popper's idea was slightly more subtle, and that is that the world must be viewed not only as a thing of the physical, but also a thing of the idea, that ideas and physicality between them create the world as we know it, and that anything we look at, feel, experience can never be reduced just to the physical. It's always packaged in ideas. And he called it the three worlds theory because he had consciousness as the conduit, the thing that joins the world of the idea with the world of the physical is consciousness. And so that idea of the world being made of ideas. And I heard Stephen Rose in an interview recently, a neuroscientist, talking really nicely about, in a very down-to-earth way, about a football match. He says a football match is made up of biological units, it is made up of grass and geology below that, and it's made up of physics, but it's also made up of ideas, rules, scorings, histories, tribal affiliations, etc., etc. So you can't actually reduce a football match to its physical component, nor to just its ideas, but these two things interact, and that we often don't take that perspective, and particularly in a world that is highly tuned to reductionism now, I think we often forget the idea perspective. We think of the idea as something that emerges from the physical, but we must remember that all our models of the physical also emerge from the idea.
I don't want to give away the end of the book, obviously.
Good,
but
good.
I can't say it was the cheeriest ending I've ever encountered in
sure.
a novel. On the other hand, the book's called Genesis, which is obviously where Adam comes in, but which suggests a beginning. It suggests a bit of hope.
And I think that's where I would love some readers to go. For many, it's like, gosh, that's crushing. There is this thing that has ended. But for a certain type of reader who has been sympathetic to art as well as to Adam, there is a sense of beginning also. And then there's a whole new reinterpretation, because we talked about the Republic. But by the end of the novel, you then have the post-Republic society. And within that, you have the notion of an idea that must be controlled. And that's another theme that just fascinates me. And the novel I'm writing, I've just finished writing, actually goes here. And that is that idea, is there such a thing as an idea that we should, as people, quash, that knowing it, we'd rather we didn't know it? Or is that ideal of us as things that interact with all knowledge so strong that you should never quash any idea? And that sort of fascinates me. And we just get a hint of that at the end of the novel.
That's a very interesting question. I hope I might have you back in a little while to talk about that. The book is called Genesis. It's published by Text Publishing, and I've been talking to the author, Bernard Beckett. Bernard, thank you very much indeed.
Hey, thank you. A pleasure talking to you.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone. And we turn now to a tradition that seems to be at least as old, if not older, than the classical rationalism of Plato. Vedanta is a spiritual tradition set out in the Upanishads, the ancient Hindu scriptures. And like those manuscripts, it's concerned with self-realization. The name implies the goal of all knowledge. But Vedanta is said by its practitioners to be not religion, but science. Here is one such practitioner, the Vedanta teacher Sunandaji, whom I spoke to on her recent visit to Australia.
The various thinkers, the various religious systems, the various sciences that are available in the world, you could say, are different paths leading to one truth. But Vedanta, you could say, excels because of its scientific, approach. And it would take you up to the point short of the truth. Thereafter, it's your own journey.
By scientific, do you mean orderly, not random, or do you mean something else?
Not just orderly. It also means these truths are time-tested. You know how a science develops? You first of all have to make observations, collect your facts, put them in order, ensure that these are facts by several experiments that you conduct. When you draw intelligent conclusions from your experiments, you further consolidate these experiments until you can convert them into laws. Much the same way has Vedanta developed. What Vedanta gives you, when I say a science, it gives you the laws of life, which you could try and find out the truth of its statements for yourself in life. And that's how you build what we call wisdom, or you gain wisdom. And with that wisdom, you find your way to the truth.
What in the context of Vedanta would constitute an experiment?
For example, we talk about who the individual is, what a human being is constituted of. So when we talk about the mind is defined. When we talk about the intellect is defined. Now, how do you know these are facts? You could apply it in your own life and see how they are facts and find out the truth for yourself. So in such a manner, you would be able to understand yourself better, and then you know how to carry yourself forward.
And you said that as well as experiments, there are laws, which sounds a very scientific way of proceeding from experiments to laws. What would the laws be? Can you give an example of what the laws are?
I did say just now that a human being has these two equipments, the mind and intellect. Now, what Vedanta says or tells us is, first of all, there's a clear distinction between the two. Because oftentimes, the human being is said to have a mind. But what is the mind? The mind in you is something which is far more inferior than the intellect in you, which is a subtler equipment. The underlying principle is anything subtle can control the gross. So when we say the mind is inferior, it is gross compared to the intellect. So the intellect would be subtler than the mind. How do we prove this? Now, the mind in you is that which feels emotions. Now, you may love your family, you may love something, but when it interferes with your judgment, when it interferes with your goal, with your ideal, you find that you're able to make a decision. You're able to follow the ideal and not really fall a prey to an emotion. Now, how does that happen? Because if you are working from the intellect, if you are identifying with an ideal, that subtle function helps you to control something gross, which is an emotion. Likewise, the mind has a control over the body. That's easier to understand. Now, let's say, you are really hungry and you're about to eat a meal and you hear some very distressing news. When you hear some distressing news, you've got the table laid out, you've got a great appetite, you're about to eat, but you hear distressing news. Your mind is disturbed. The moment your mind is disturbed, I ask you, what happens to your appetite? You're not able to eat. You just can't have anything. How is that? The subtle controls the gross. So compared to the body, the mind is subtle. Compared to the mind, the intellect is subtle. So that's how you establish the law, that the subtle controls the gross. And this is what Vedanta tells you.
There's a long-standing Western view of the way in which the mind and the intellect work, which would go like this. The intellect is a sort of torch. You have to point it at something in order to seek to understand that thing. How do you know where to point it? That is where the emotions come in. They give you a direction, they give you a desire in which to go. So the intellect, according to that view, is useless, it's indolent until it's put into action by the mind, by the emotions. Are you rejecting that view?
I wouldn't reject that view, but what we need to understand is how the two work. An example probably would, you know, make it clearer. Now, the mind in us is like a flow of water. The intellect works like the banks of a river. Now, all that Vedanta is saying is, ensure that the banks of the river is strong. Then the flow has meaning, it is beneficial. In fact, if the banks of the river are not strong, what happens is what is a benefit becomes a curse. It could inundate the fields. It could devastate things. So that is the nature of one's mind, or rather that is the capacity of one's mind. It could behave, it could misbehave, it could destroy you. So there is something else in you, which is the intellect, and that is supposed to police the mind, direct the mind, support the mind, not destroy the mind.
What is the relationship between Vedanta and the Upanishads, the sacred text, and also the broader history of Hinduism?
The Upanishads come from the larger text called the Vedas. Now, Vedas, thousands of years ago, were conveyed by word of mouth. It was never written. So it went down from teacher to taught. There are four basic Vedas, and at the end of the Vedas, the Upanishads were found because they gave the essence of the philosophy. They gave out their essence. And this essence is what Vedanta is all about. And what Hinduism is in a broader perspective, catering a system of life, of rituals, of thought, come together to cater to a people living in a particular geographical place. That's the Indian culture. So Hinduism works much like a hospital, and it caters to all sorts of people. If you look at Hinduism, it starts from very strange rituals, you could say, to the highest philosophical thought. And that would be really the range of people who need to fall back on this religion to find their answers to truth. But what Vedanta does is, whether you follow Hinduism or Islam or Christianity or any faith, what you need to do is to find a path, a clear-cut path to get you to the truth. And that's where Vedanta is common to all.
Sunandaji, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
You'll find more on Sunandaji and on Vedanta on the Vedanta Australia website, and you'll find the address of that on our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. The show is produced by Kyla Slaven, with technical production this week by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. The reading was by Jackie May. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.